And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Matthew Fox, the theologian. We're still trying to get Rupert Sheldrake, by the way, live in the United Kingdom. Can't quite find him yet. So we'll do the best we can, but we're going to take some of your calls on angels with Matthew when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We'll keep trying, Matthew, to get Rupert on, but so far he's a no-show. So we're going to let you carry the rest of the way. And we'll take some calls, too, with you, too. They're lining up already wanting to talk about this. What is it about angels that makes so many people just wake up?
That's a great question. Well, I think it opens up a whole nother layers of life, you know, that life is not just the two-dimensional or even one-dimensional. It's very multidimensional, and it includes invisible presences and experiences we have. You know, everything that exists is not necessarily quantifiable or visible, and you know, there's a whole world out there that's just very interesting, and why wouldn't it be? You know, our imaginations, they want to, they want to get in on the act. You know, our imaginations, they want to roam, and you know, why not roam beyond just the realms of the of what's visible? And after all, we know how real our feelings are, and they're not things either. You know, I mean, everything in the universe is not a thing. In fact, what science is finding is that even atoms, you know, are not things in themselves. They're more about relationships. So angels are real good at relationships. They're about connecting. And I think they just to talk about this kind of takes a lid off of people's heads, and it opens up possibilities that our schools, our television, even most of our churches don't talk about. The realm of intuition, the realm of mysticism, the realm of spirit and communication. And it's not an opposition to our intellects or rationality. It's a both and thing. You can be both rational and beyond the rational. You can be both rational and playful and rational and creative. And also it's about creativity. You know, this whole idea of muses, you know, that the angels have a lot to do with creativity. And creativity is not promoted in our school systems and the rest like it should be. And so I think people are eager to talk about creativity, eager to talk about their mystical experiences and their experiences of angels and ancestors. All that, I think, is part of the picture.
And Matthew, do angels ever just lose their temper, lose their cool with human beings? It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that they can certainly express a disappointment. I think, in fact, that's one thing Lorna writes about, that the angels are disappointed at how slowly our species has evolved at the level of consciousness and wisdom and love, that we're not evolving nearly as fast as we need to, that we're still stuck in what I would call our reptilian brains. You know, that's what all this war is about, you know, and it's we're kind of stuck. And she does talk about that there's a disappointment. She doesn't talk about them ranting and raving and being angry, but they feel we could be doing a lot better than we're doing. We could be evolving a lot further. We need to move from knowledge to wisdom. And to do that, I think we need a new school system. I think we need to redo religion. Mm-hmm. I think we have to redo a lot on our plates. And so, again, creativity is the key in all this. And that's one reason we ought to call on the angels, to call on any spirits that are going to encourage us to think bigger and to love more and to get the bigger picture.
I'm going to send the angels out to look for Rupert Sheldrake. Maybe we'll find him. Let's take some calls here. Let's go to Samuel in Kansas City, Missouri, first-time caller. Samuel, go ahead.
Hi, Samuel. Hi, George.
Hi, Sam.
Samuel. I just became a Coast Insider, so I'm going to get to hear myself sound like an idiot tomorrow. I had a question. I had a question. If can angels come in human form? And if so, how would I know if somebody I've seen is an angel?
Ah, it's like the City of Angels with Nicolas Cage. Can they come in human form, Matthew?
Definitely. They can take on any form. They can come as animals, too. Some of them do come, I think, as our pets. And, yeah, they can take on any form. And that's one thing that's very interesting, that they're not restricted by form like we are. Just like they're not really restricted by time and space. They can travel at the speed of light. So definitely, they can take on many forms. Mm-hmm.
When people are with angels and they summon them up, do the angels then leave on their own accord? Do they wait to make sure you're okay? What do they do?
Well, again, I think it would vary in the circumstances, but I know one fellow who's a very grounded person who's a scientist, and his wife, who's a lawyer, who were visited by angels on a regular basis. And he came to talk to me after this book came out because he said, I've not been able to talk to anyone about it. And he actually recorded, he and his wife recorded the conversation between the angels and them. And and the angels really helped him to be much stronger and to really follow his vision and his conscience. And he's done a lot of great things in the world since he was visited by these angels. So it's not just that we summon them up, but sometimes they call us. It works both ways, you might say. But definitely, you can call on them, and they may respond in a very subtle way, or they may actually respond with genuine communication.
Let's go to Kelsey in Denver, where it's very, very cold. Hi, Kelsey.
Yeah, the cold makes us stronger.
So. Yeah, sure does.
There you go.
Okay. But I have been deeply influenced by the rebel religious, like the rebel Catholics, like Dorothy Day, and the Sisters of Loretto from Kentucky. And my very own Catholic worker house here in Denver. Mm-hmm. And Matthew Fox did some beautiful rave masses up in the mountains that I wanted to go to. So I am a fanatic of Matthew Fox.
Excellent. There you go. A nice compliment for you, Matthew.
Thank you. Yes. So we do these. We call it the Cosmic Mass. We're doing them now here again in Oakland, where I live, Oakland, California. But we have done them up in the mountains, and we've done them in a number of places. And it's a matter of bringing rave and dance and postmodern language, rap, and VJs and DJs into liturgy and making it alive again. And we've had powerful results. Yeah, we're doing one December 7th here in Oakland.
And Matthew, the angels have found Rupert.
Hey,
so let's bring him on. Rupert Sheldrake's with us, of course, the biologist, noted author, of course. Rupert, welcome back to Coast, sir.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
How you been? How you feeling these days?
Pretty well. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. We've got Matthew on and you. And so we've been talking about your book, The Physics of Angels, and I got the theologian angle from Matthew, Rupert. Now I want to get the little scientific end of it, too. Tell me about the mix between science and theology when we talk about angels and what you were able to discover.
Well, basically, the thing about this is it's to do with consciousness. We have a science at the moment that says the whole universe is unconscious. The entire universe is made of just unconscious matter, and the only conscious things are human brains and maybe the brains of higher animals and possibly ETs of one kind or another. Whereas I think we're moving into a completely different vision of nature scientifically, where to see that consciousness pervades the whole universe. You know, even stars might be conscious. I mean, we're living in a world that can be seen in a completely different way. And the point about angels is that they're a traditional way of thinking in the Western tradition about forms of consciousness beyond the human level. A lot of people even religious people, have a kind of collapsed view where there's human consciousness and there's God's consciousness and there's sort of nothing in between except a machine-like universe. But if we live in a living world, there could be many kinds of intelligence or consciousness in that world, and I think there are. And the traditional way of thinking about them is in terms of the angels, the innumerable numbers of intelligent, conscious beings in the universe, not outside the universe, but in the universe. And so this exploration of what might seem sort of arcane, sort of the theories from the Middle Ages and stuff, is actually rather relevant today because nobody's thought about lots of levels of consciousness in the universe since about 16th or 17th century. And if we start thinking about it again, it's good to learn from what people thought before, people who thought about it, experienced angels, wrote about it. And so the chance of doing this exploration with Matthew was something that I found very exciting. And this book is a product of this exploration.
Was it difficult to tie science into the angelic realm when you started putting this together?
Well, not really, because part of the theory of angels is to do with cosmology. The traditional view of angels is not just what a lot of people today imagine, you know, guardian angels turning up to help you when your car breaks down, that kind of thing. It's much more about the cosmos. What are the animating principles of the stars, the planets, and so forth? And so when you start thinking about the stars, and before the scientific revolution, people thought that when they looked at the sky, that they were looking up into a sky full of intelligence, consciousness, and the stars were intelligent beings with minds and thoughts and influences. Part of that influence of the heavenly realms was thought of in terms of the angelic intelligence. So when you think in terms of cosmology, and the possibility of the cosmos being alive rather than dead, then that fits in with the idea of cosmic angels. And then the other thing about it is that when you actually read something of what they wrote about angels, there's a passage in St. Thomas Aquinas, I don't know if Matthew's already mentioned it, which is astonishingly like quantum physics. They're discussing... St. Thomas is discussing how angels move. And what he says is that an angel is known by its action. It's not just a kind of abstract entity. It does something. And if it does something in one place, and then it does something in another place, it must move between them. And when it acts, it has to act with its whole being. It can't act with part of its being. Now, that sounds like a quantum in quantum physics. The quantum of action is called, the full name of quantum is quantum of action. And a quantum acts with its full being or not at all. And so then he talks about how they move. And he says, from the point of view of the angel, moving from one place to another takes no time. But from the point of view of an external observer, it does take time. Now, that's amazingly like Einstein's discussion of the movement of photons. A photon leaves the sun, takes 8 minutes to travel to the Earth, and then it's absorbed by something in a quantum of action. But from the point of view of the photon, no time has elapsed. From the point of view of an external observer, 8 minutes has elapsed. So there's this peculiar parallel between this discussion in the Middle Ages by St. Thomas Aquinas of the movement of angels and Einstein's discussion of the movement of photons. I suppose it's that if you think about how something that's not material, because photons are not material, according to physics, they're not made of matter. They're made of energy, but not of matter. I suppose if you think about how a non-material entity can move from one place to another, you end up with the same kind of conclusions. But this is a remarkable parallel. And it's one reason why our book's called The Physics of Angels, because there's this rather striking parallel to a core part of quantum theory in the angelology of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Rupert, I got Matthew's take on the evil part of what's out there, because the fallen angels, of course, were the evil ones. Did you look at that on the scientific end?
Well, I don't think there's, from the scientific point of view, I suppose the parallel here is that you have the way in which, in a holistic way, the every kind of holistic science, not just my own, but every kind of holistic science, has a view of the universe being made up of different levels. There's the subatomic particles in the atom, atoms in molecules, molecules in crystals, in living organisms, organelles in cells, cells in tissues, tissues in organs, organs in organisms, organisms in societies, societies in ecosystems, or planets in solar systems, in galaxies. But wherever you look, there's a kind of wholeness that's more than the sum of the parts, which in turn is part of a greater whole. And this is the order of nature. Now, the way that they thought about the fall of the angels in these medieval authors that we discuss in our book, The Physics of Angels, is that they were stepping out of the right order of things. And you see, what happens if you have this whole in part, each cell in your body is part of a tissue, each tissue is part of an organ. Now, where everything's in balance, when the wholeness of the tissue is subordinated to the wholeness of the organ, when it fits into the larger order of things. Arthur Koestler discussed these nested hierarchies or holarchies of your organization and pointed out that each one has an integrative tendency. There's a tendency for a cell to integrate in a tissue, but in order to remain a separate cell, it has to have a self-assertive tendency as well. And if that self-assertive tendency becomes too strong, the cell becomes cancerous. It breaks out of the order within which it's part. Now, the picture of the fallen angels that we get in St. Thomas Aquinas and some of these other authors is very like that, that they're part of an order of things. They have their own autonomy, but they're part of a larger whole. And the story of the fall of Satan is really the story of an angelic being who's part of a larger order who asserts his own autonomy out of the order of things. And then it's a bit like a cell becoming cancerous. This becomes a very disruptive force within the cosmos.
Do you think Satan, Rupert, had free will in as much as he elected, I think, to take that path that he went down? Could he have stopped at any time?
Yes. I think the whole point is that this is something that had free will. I mean, Satan, the fall wouldn't have been a fall if there wasn't an issue of free will involved.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been simply following a predestined program. It would have been part of the order of nature. Whereas the point about the fall is that it involves a choice that could have been otherwise. So I think that the whole point about it is that there's a choice involved.
All right, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. Rupert Sheldrake with us, Matthew Fox, as we talk about their work, The Physics of Angels. Need to contact me, George at coasttocoastam.com. And next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Matthew Fox and Rupert Sheldrake as we talk about their work, The Physics of Angels. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Rupert Sheldrake with us, Matthew Fox as well. Matthew, let me bring you in for this as well as we continue talking about your work, The Physics of Angels. These angels that are out there, created, of course, by God, or were they just created by themselves? What do you think?
You mean that they birthed themselves?
Yeah, did they?
Oh. I doubt it. No, I think that they're part of the rest of creation, and I think that it, you know, we're still obviously exploring just how things come to be, but the actual act of existence itself is the great mystery. And that's really, well, probably the most raw name for God is existence, the existence within existence itself. Like Meister Eckhart says, isness is God. So the real miracle is existence. And I don't think any particular being claims that. we're all part of it, and that's the real marvel and the joy of life. So I think that angels too are made. They didn't do their own making.
Hey, Rupert, I think on that fateful day, on that event you were at, you probably had an angel there with you, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that I sometimes feel I'm protected, yes.
With,
I don't know exactly how.
But they're there. But they're there. What can people do to summon them up? I mean, what do? You simply ask? I mean, does science have an answer for that?
I don't think science has an answer, because that's not something science looks into. Until quite recently, the science has been based on the principle the universe is unconscious, and so that you can't summon anything up except by physically sort of moving it there by mechanical force. So I think to understand how we could summon angels, we have to understand the dynamics of consciousness. And the best way to understand that is through our own consciousness, because we know more about human consciousness than any other kind. And how we summon up people in our own world is we call them by name. And it's an interesting fact that all prayers start with, all the ones I can think of, start with an invocation, you know, like Our Father or Hail Mary or come Holy Ghost. You know, the prayers start with an invocation. So I suppose that the way to summon any conscious being is to call it by name. The same with animals. If we want to call our dog or cat, we call it by name. So I suppose that naming angels is an important part of that. I don't know. What do you think, Matthew?
Well, I like what you're saying. It's a second person relationship, summoning up and calling another. It's I, thou. And but of course, if you don't know the name, you can still summon them. And hopefully a name might come through. But it's about intention too, isn't it? And again, if you think about the creative act, you think of a musician or a painter or something, or anyone trying to do something that's excellent or something from their deepest depths, that you do kind of summon. I mean, I like that word summon and call, and as you say, that's really a part of, it's the invocation, the calling forth. Yeah.
Matthew, what do you think the role of angels might be? I mean, what's the intent?
Well, Aquinas says angels cannot help but love, so I think that they're about love, they're about wisdom, not just knowledge, they're about courage, they are about protection, but they're about, as Rupert was saying, fitting us into the order of things, the greater order of things. I mean, I would say that if you look at the human race today and what we're doing to the planet, that we're involved in a great deal of disorder and disruption as Rupert was defining evil to be, a disruptive force. So we need to find the appropriate balance. You know, how do we fit into this amazing planet without plundering it and using it but not abusing it, and returning and not just taking? And so I think angels could be very, very helpful for us at that level of finding our proper place. And another word for that is humility. And humility isn't about berating yourself, but it comes from the same word as the word earth in Latin. Humus means earth. So it's about finding our place on this earth with the other earth beings, whether we're talking the oceans or the forests or the soil or the air. I mean, here, Peking, they had this big event in Peking this week, and they had to stop all cars for a week just so that people might be able to breathe when these world leaders come to town. So, you know, clearly we're out of balance. And I think angels could really be agents of purification, literally, not only of the air, but of our minds, so that we can think more clearly about what we should and should not be doing in living on this planet.
Rupert, how about you? What do you think the role of these angels might be?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I think that many of them are to do with the ordering of the entire cosmos. I mean, the vast majority of angelic activity is out there in the universe, you know, in the stars and the galaxies, and most of it's probably not directly related to us, because we, after all, occupy only a tiny fraction of the entire cosmos here on Earth in our solar system. But the local angels, the ones that are concerned with the ordering of the solar system and of the Earth, I'm sure are very concerned with what's going on. And so the question is, how can we relate to them? How can they relate to us in finding a way that doesn't destroy the planet we're living on? And I think part of that is our becoming aware that we're part of a larger order of things rather than simply here to make personal profit or corporate profits or our own short-term interests. And the angels are the principles of conscious order. The consciousnesses that are to do with the way things are ordered. So I think that the ones that are concerned with the regulation of the atmosphere, the seas, the oceans, the continents, I suppose we can ask their help. And how they would help, I don't know. I mean, they have their own ways of working, but I would imagine that they'd work in several ways. One of them would be through human minds. One of the ways in which consciousness beyond the human level works through humans is through humans. And that's by inspiring people, strengthening people, giving them courage in seeing what needs to be done and helping them to do it. They might also work directly through nature. You know, we get wake-up calls from nature. Say there was a solar flare, that, you know, these coronal mass ejections and flares on the sun, they're happening quite frequently on the sun, but they're normally pointed away from the Earth. If one of them is pointed to the Earth, it could take out our power system, our communication system, and we could have sudden, unexpected disasters. I mean, radio, television, computer networks, power grids could all go down. We know that when there are these solar flares that hit the Earth, there can be massive power outages. We haven't had a really big one since we've had huge grids, transmission lines, which are like aerials for solar flares and could cause the meltdowns of transformers and stuff. But there could be a huge wake-up call, quite unexpectedly reaching the Earth from the sun, for example.
Oh, sure, no doubt about that.
And if it happens, do we just say, well, that's blind chance? You know, it's just the sun randomly ejected a coronal mass ejection towards the Earth? Or might it be an intervention that's mediated by an angel that thinks sort of shock therapy is necessary? Mm-hmm.
Or would the angel, Rupert, would the angel block it with a shield, for example, and maybe that X flare doesn't hit us?
Well, that's possible. But, you know, in terms of our greater good, it's not necessarily if you were an angel thinking about how to get humanity out of this global crisis we're in. You know, if you can imagine angels discussing it with each other, what to do, it wouldn't necessarily be to ensure that business as usual continues unimpeded on Earth, would it? It might be that shock tactics were necessary, some enormous shock to the system that would wake people up. So it's hard to know.
Another dimension, I think, to back up to what you said about humans, working through humans, is, of course, our creativity. You know, to really come up with clean energy, solar and wind and thermal and all the rest. And, I mean, here in India, they've invented now a car that runs on air, compressed air. Well, that seems like a pretty good thing for the environment. And so the whole idea of exciting human creativity and imagination is something that angels are very much about, because they operate in the realm of intuition. And so many artists do have experiences of angels in their when they're in a creative state. So I think that's another place where angels could be hyperactive today especially if we called on them.
Do you think angels, Matthew, held the hand of Michelangelo?
Well, I don't know that held the hand, but yeah, I think they were involved, definitely. And, you know, we have to reinvent education today. We have to reinvent politics, economics, for sure, and religion. And I think all of that, angels would be eager to, and worship. And I think angels would be very eager to assist us in all of that.
Rupert, when science is combined with theology, do they mesh, or which one wins?
Well, it depends what kind of science and what kind of theology. You know, there isn't a single science or a single theology. The mechanistic science that's dominated since the 17th century and the materialist form of it, which dominated since the 19th century, leaves no scope for theology. In fact, it's almost purposely designed not to. It's designed to give a picture of a world that works completely mechanically and automatically in accordance with impersonal laws, just driven on by the flow of energy. A totally unconscious world. Now, in that sort of world, there's no place for God or angels or theology. That's why many atheists are so committed to a materialist worldview. Atheists aren't people who don't believe anything. They're usually people who are heavily committed to materialism, philosophical materialism, mm-hmm. the doctrine that matter's the only reality. Now, that kind of science leaves no space for angels or God, or even for human minds, for that matter, because they're just supposed to be products of the mechanical activity of our brains. But if we move into a post-materialist science, which is where the sciences are moving now, there's a often called a paradigm shift, moving towards a new view of nature. That's a view of nature in which consciousness does have a place, where we see that something mind-like is present even in atoms and electrons and stars and suns. Now, in that kind of world, where there's much more role for consciousness, then I think there's much more role for an interface between the consciousness of humans and of other parts of nature and spiritual beings, intelligences like angels. So the angels will come back when we move into a new paradigm science where consciousness plays a major role throughout the entire universe, not just inside human brains as a product of brain of nerve cell activity. So I think that's the crucial thing that we come. One of the most exciting things about my conversations with Matthew Fox over the years is exploring where the new frontiers in science and theology can do mesh together. Because old-style theology, since the 17th century, there's been a kind of mechanistic theology, particularly strong in the Protestant world, which accepts the idea of nature as a machine and sees God as a machine maker, as an engineer designing the machinery from outside, a dead mechanical world. Humans have consciousness in that world and they relate to God, but the rest of nature is seen as mechanical and unconscious. And I think that kind of theology doesn't leave much place for angels either. But I think we have to move beyond that old style mechanistic theology and mechanistic science. And in the new living universe that we're coming into, I think we have a completely different way of seeing how these realms can relate.
Robert, do you think that the angelic realm is more spiritual or more scientific or both?
Well, spirituality is to do with consciousness, isn't it? It's to do with experience and to do with creativity, thoughts, ideas, motivations, intentions. Now, science, on the whole, has left those things out, mechanistic science. But as we move into this world of consciousness studies, which is now an important part of science, then consciousness is becoming part of science. It ought to have been part of science all along, and psychology is meant to be the study of human consciousness, but in the 20th century, that got missed out. Now we're getting to a rather exciting realm of consciousness studies, where consciousness is becoming part of science. And so to say that something's spiritual or scientific as if they're opposed is no longer the case. For example, there is now many studies of meditation, mindfulness and other kinds of meditation, studies that look at the scientific side, what's changing in the brain, what are the health effects, etc., and also the subjective side, what actually happens to people's consciousness as they do this. And these, so it's not as if one is in completely one compartment, the other's in another. We're reaching a stage in science, thank goodness, where the two can come together. And I think studies of the things that are spiritual in their effect, like near-death experiences too, those are also being investigated scientifically. And as you know, the studies show that when people are having near-death experiences, there may be virtually no activity in their brain at all. So it's not just disordered brains, anoxia of the brain or something. The spiritual experience, the near-death experience, and the physical changes that are happening in the body can be studied together, and they can illuminate each other. So it's not as if it's totally separate realms with nothing to say to each other. I think we're finding more and more examples where there can be a joint investigation of these things.
I think so, too. And Matthew, very quickly, every picture of angels depicts wings, yet I'm told they really don't have them. What's that all about?
Well, as we touched on earlier, you know, angels can take any form they want.
Right.
So sometimes they do take a form with wings, I think. Lorna Byrne has said that. But often they don't. She talks about angels as orbs of light. And Hildegard of Bingen back in the 12th century also used that naming of angels as orbs of light. So I think you just have to stay very flexible about what form, if any, angels will take. And they can take the form of a human being, the form of animals or pets.
Just about anything they want. We're going to come back final hour with both of you, and we'll take some phone calls.